Todd Patrick Weathersby against the Commonwealth, Mr. Mazzio and Mr. Jeffrey. Mr. Mazzio, good afternoon, sir.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. If I could have 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
May it please the court, I'm Dan Mazzio on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Weathersby. And it's my position this afternoon that the trial court in this case was incorrect in denying Mr. Weathersby's motion to suppress for two reasons. First, that the officer, Comats, in this particular case, lacked legal justification to perform the pat-down of his person searching for weapons. And secondly, that going further, Officer Comats lacked any probable cause to proceed from that pat-down to a search of the appellant's pockets.
Let me stop you right there.
Yes, Judge.
I understand on brief your position is that, and actually maybe I should ask you to clarify your position because it was not completely clear to me. Maybe I'm making an assumption, but my assumption was that you were not disputing the issue of whether the officer had reasonable suspicion to detain your client for investigation, just that he lacked any reason to pat him down. Is that correct?
I think, Your Honor, I'm not conceding that initially that there was reasonable suspicion, but I will agree, Judge, that as I was reviewing the record, I think that on appeal, faced with the inferences that are in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, I think the Commonwealth had a much stronger argument as to the temporary detention in this case than to the other two issues, which I found much more clearly in violation of Mr. Weathersby's rights. So,
would you also agree, or I shouldn't say also, but would you agree that if we conclude that the officer here had not just reasonable suspicion but actually probable cause to conduct an arrest, then the issue of the pat-down sort of goes away because then we'd have a search incident to an arrest?
Judge, I think if the court concludes based on the totality that probable cause for arrest existed, then you're absolutely right that the rest of the issues are moot.
Okay, so then getting back to the issue of the pat-down, assuming only reasonable suspicion exists, for the purposes of my question at least, why do you say that the officer lacked any authority to pat him down?
Well, and again, Judge, I didn't assign error specifically to it, but I'm not conceding necessarily that reasonable suspicion existed, just that the Commonwealth's argument on that is stronger than it would be.
Assuming we disagree with your position on the reasonable suspicion and think there is reasonable suspicion, given that he's running away from the scene and sort of matches the description of the person leaving the store and so forth, assuming all that is enough for reasonable suspicion, why couldn't the officer pat him down under those circumstances?
And Judge, without agreeing that he does match the description, but we can certainly come back to you. I think it's a two-part analysis. That first, can he perform the stop and then potentially temporarily detain this individual for the purpose of investigation is one question. Can he go further than that and then pat the individual down to determine whether or not they possess any weapons is a secondary question. I think it requires some additional analysis that those two things are often very much intertwined, and the elements that might relate to one often relate to the other. In this particular case, I don't find that to be the case. The fact that he was a white male who was in a generous description for the Commonwealth, I would suggest, in the same general area that a larceny had been committed sometime before, might put the Commonwealth in position to argue that, in the light most favorable on review, that the officer could have temporarily detained that individual to perhaps ask him some questions, or I know the Commonwealth's position is likely to be that it was appropriate for him to perform some type of a show-up, but there are no factors that I see in the record to suggest that this individual may have been armed and dangerous, that there would be any reason to believe that there would be a pat-down necessary under these circumstances.
Well, if there's going to be a show-up, though, wouldn't there be the argument that the officer would have the ability to pat him down for safety because he's going to have to stick him in his patrol car, where he would then have access to the officer? Where does that go to your argument?
I don't think that there's anything in the record to suggest that that was a necessity at this point. Apparently, the loss prevention or security officer from Walmart was close enough in vicinity that they felt this person might be connected to the offense. And certainly it would not be unusual for an individual to come to a scene versus the officer taking an individual back to a different location. Either of those things would be fairly common. I don't think there's anything in this particular case that would have prevented the officer from bringing the security guard or loss prevention officer over to the location where the individual was and simply asking him to have a seat on the curb and wait for that to occur. In that situation, I don't think that based on the facts in the record, there's any reason to believe that that individual would be armed and dangerous in such a way that would...
Well, I think Judge Malvo's point is simply that assuming reasonable suspicion exists, then there's an absolute right for a limited detention for the purpose of investigation. Now, it seems to me it's sort of up to the officer, especially when you've only got one police officer involved who's got to deal with both the suspect and witnesses. And if the officer chooses to isolate the suspect in his police car while he's speaking to the witnesses and getting more details about whatever it is that they saw, why is that an unreasonable approach? He could have done something different, but why is what he did unreasonable? And if it's not unreasonable, then it seems to me a pat-down might be appropriate under those circumstances.
Judge, I think there could have been evidence in the record along the lines of what Your Honor is suggesting. I don't think that that's the case here. I don't think that there were any other witnesses that were present or testified to. I don't think that there were any additional circumstances to suggest that transporting this particular individual was necessary. I think what we're talking about is, from a reasonable standpoint, is it reasonable for the officer to make a decision that violates Mr. Weathersby's constitutional rights in a way that we are accepting as a result of their additional elements that we have to balance? And in this case, to violate Mr. Weathersby's rights in order to take him to a different location as opposed to a person coming there, I would argue the court certainly could conclude it reasonable, but I would disagree.
Okay.
Further, Your Honor, or Your Honors, I think that once the pat-down occurs, the evidence in the record suggests that the officer finds a round cylindrical item. There is no additional evidence or description given about the item. We don't know if that item is more akin to a battery or to a straw. The officer then immediately goes into the back pocket and retrieves the item.
Well, isn't the standard there whether or not it's a weapon, not necessarily whether it's a firearm? In other words, if the officer feels something that might conceivably be a weapon as opposed to something that couldn't possibly be a weapon, then, you know, if it's conceivable that it might be a weapon, whether it's a could be used as a club or a knife or whatever, isn't he entitled to retrieve it under Terry versus Ohio?
I think if the officer had testified in such a way that suggested that what he believed he felt was a weapon and that this court found that description to be a reasonable one, then I would agree with you.
I thought you said it was a hard cylindrical object, or words to that effect.
I believe that, well, I believe the exact quote, Judge, is a round cylindrical tube. So I don't, at least in my understanding
of
those words.
Could have been a gun, I suppose, or it could have been, you know, could have been anything. But certainly, if it's round and cylindrical and not soft, it could be a weapon, couldn't it?
Well, anything, I imagine, if we expand our imaginations and what's possible could potentially be a weapon. But I think under the case law, there's got to be, the officer has to offer some explanation absent what might be obvious to a trier of fact to determine that something was clearly potentially a weapon, which I would argue that a round cylindrical tube does not do that to any person who would hear those terms. The officer would have to offer some explanation for why he believed such to be the case, and this court would have to determine whether that was reasonable. I don't think in this case that anything exists along those lines. Judge, there's not even in this particular case what we might often see testified to by an officer that from their training and experience that they suspected that this particular item was X, Y, or Z. Simply, the testimony was there was a round cylindrical tube, he felt it during the pat-down, and he immediately went and retrieved the item. I think under the case law, Judge, that is clearly, I would argue, a violation of Mr. Weathersby's rights, and that the court should have suppressed that evidence based on that basis.
All right. So we got about 6 minutes left. Mr. Jeffrey?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth. To go back to this point about no testimony from the officer about his belief, of course, the standard in all Fourth Amendment analysis is objective. Now, we do sometimes have that type of testimony. I thought it was a gun, or based on my experience and training, I thought it was a smoking device, or things of that nature, which we don't have in this record. But that's not essential to reach the issue that's before you.
But Mr. Jeffries, going to the Terry stop, there has to be some indication that the person is either armed or dangerous. Is there any indication in reference to the pat down of the appellant here that was a justification as to patting him down?
In terms of being able to pat down based
yes.
on the armed and dangerous? Again, we certainly base that on the totality of the circumstances.
Well, and that's what I'm asking in that vein. We've got somebody who we know apparently could have been involved in a larceny. We don't have any indication from anybody in Walmart that he had a weapon or was being aggressive. When he encounters the officer, there are no other things that he testifies to in terms of any type of behavior, any type of environmental aspects, such as a high crime area, anything else.
Except for the part that you said about the behavior, I probably would...
He runs.
I think he does more than run, though. Okay. And I think that's a... I don't know if it's an imperative distinction, but there is more than that, because you've got the running, and then you've got the part of the concealment in those thick bushes. The description was essentially that there was some breadth to those. I'm not using the officer's exact words, and that they were about 4 feet high. So, and he jumped backwards into them. I really just focused on that last night. So you've got flight, concealment, and essentially I've got to reach down, but he says reach down with my wrist and grab them and pull them out. So I think that's an additional factor. I think it's like flight, but I think, I guess I'll use the term flight plus. You definitely have more than that there.
Well, using your terminology of flight plus, how does that get you to the objective standards in reference to what's needed to support the pat down for weapons?
Okay, and I want to go back to what you said a minute ago, because your point is well taken. We don't have... This isn't the nexus between guns and drugs type of thing. We don't have that type of offense. You correctly point out that we don't have anything from the Walmart to indicate that this individual was armed at the time of committing the offense, assuming it's even the individual that they were looking for. But, again, the touchstone of any Fourth Amendment analysis is reasonableness. You've got to rely on the totality of the circumstances. And the whole purpose, the whole justification for this pat-down is officer safety, and Judge Humphreys, I know you wrote one of those opinions, I guess it's Baker, where essentially the officer says, anybody I meet in that neighborhood, I'm going to pat down. And again, I'm taking a bit of license with it. We all know that's not the law, but we have more
than... No automatic pat downs.
But we do have, again, part of the reasonable safety concerns, and this court has said it, the Supreme Court said it in McCain. You're looking at things like... The time of day does have some bearing on it. The flight, and to use my term, which hopefully dies here and never sees a court opinion anywhere, the flight plus.
Yeah, that ever going to humiliate you forevermore with putting it in an opinion.
Just don't put quotation marks around it and say that the Commonwealth argues, and I'll probably be in good shape there. So you have all of those things. You have the flight, and there is a degree of furtive behavior also on the U-Haul end where it's described as crouching behind the cars, and then he flees. An interesting fact, the other individual with him stays there and talks to the officers, which I guess gives them a way to distinguish. And there's no indication from the officer that he suspected this, but I guess maybe some potential issue flows from the record.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Jeffrey. What's the Commonwealth's position as to whether or not what we have here is probable cause to effect an arrest? And if so, why isn't this a search incident to an arrest?
We certainly didn't make that argument on brief, nor was that the ruling at trial. Of course, you can reach it. I hadn't given it much thought until you mentioned it a minute ago.
I mean, the standard for, if I'm remembering Blankenship correctly, I think the standard for probable cause is a reasonable basis for belief that a person has committed a crime. And if that's the case, this person, you know, is seen fleeing from, as the officer's told, this individual's fleeing from a store where a larceny has been committed, and you know he's wearing certain clothing and he has certain facial hair, and the officer sees a person, you know, is told that he ran in that direction, and the officer sees a person running in that direction and grabs him, and you know at that point obviously it's at least reasonable suspicion, it seems to me. But you know, given that, you know, that one question might be, is that in and of itself sufficient to establish a reasonable basis for belief that he's a thief? Then we're at the probable cause standard, it seems to me. Now, I don't know if the Commonwealth had a position on that, but the thought occurred to me as you were talking.
No, I think that, that notwithstanding that we didn't make the argument on brief and kind of relied on the ruling, I think there is a good faith basis to do that. He's in the area. He does flee. There are some similarities in appearance and clothing, for sure. I don't know that the nexus is super tight there, but there is some nexus there. Other than the woman who was with him, no indication that anybody else is in the immediate area. But to be perfectly candid, we do have that bit from the officer about how it's the area where, I guess he initially spots him, is an area where homeless, it's the bushes area, I'm sorry, where he fled to. That area, a lot of homeless people frequent that area, but no indication any of those other people were there at that time. But I wanted to make sure you knew that was in the record. I think it's a fair argument. The easy part of the question that you ask is that it certainly does render all of this discussion academic about Dickerson if there was probable cause to arrest, because you get the search incident to the arrest. And under right result, wrong reason, and objective standards, you can certainly reach that.
Well, I'm not sure I would necessarily, but the thought did occur to me, and I wanted your reaction to it. But getting back to, I think it was Judge Malveaux's question regarding the pat-down, as you correctly point out, the law is you can't automatically pat-down. Now, you know, police officers, of course, are always going to err on, in my experience at least, they're always going to err on the side of their own safety. And I've had more than one police officer tell me in one capacity or another that they're going to pat them down every single time, whether I like it or the law likes it or not. And my response when I was a prosecutor was always, well, do what you think will keep you safe, and if it means we lose a case, I'd rather we lost the case than I have to go to your funeral at some point. But
right.
But having said all of that, the law is what it is, and if you can't automatically pat them down, and you have to have at least some indicia that they may be armed and/or dangerous before you can pat them down, and the officer here, you know, drags him out of the bushes, knowing it seems to me at best that he's a thief. The question is whether, under those circumstances, knowing that he's a thief, that would imply, at least to some degree, that he's armed and dangerous. And I'm not sure you get there from here.
Again, time of day, the flight, the concealment in the bushes. I think Judge Malveaux mentioned this a minute ago. The show up, which I touched on, is a separate issue, because I think if he's putting him in the police car.
Well, let's take that, let's parse that. I mean,
okay.
How does running into the bushes indicate you might be armed?
I mean, certainly a reasonable...
Seems to me it would indicate the opposite. You're trying to get away because you have no way to defend yourself.
Well, that's certainly one inference, but it's not the only one. Those are my facts. That's really what I have. But I would suggest to you, he's made affirmative efforts to flee. To conceal himself.
And flight doesn't, I mean, I don't know of any case that suggests that flight equals armed.
No. In fact, the contrary is true. I think flight alone is never
I mean,
enough.
I'm not sure, even if you aggregate all these circumstances, I don't know, can you point to a case where either this court or our Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court has held that circumstances like this would reasonably lead someone, a reasonable police officer, to believe that the individual is armed and dangerous?
Fact-specific exactly like this, no. I can't. I mean, what I can say is that we've always said totality.
Yeah. Well, that's true. And, I mean, time of day, maybe.
Time
but,
of day.
But beyond that, I mean, what?
Well, I I'll say this, and I can't tell you a particular case, but I think there are some that are flight and a pretty thin reed after flight, and that's enough. I'm kind of dumbstruck as to what I might cite you for that proposition, but I think that they're out there. And we also have the I'll call it concealment. Flight plus is certainly reason to think that he's making active efforts to escape the officers. The officer is kind of forced to drag him out. I think that adds enough to the mix, especially with the time of day. And there is the additional issue of the show-up, which I think is a separate point.
Well, he's already been frisked at that point, hasn't he?
I think he said he patted him down right before he put him in the police car. I think that light most favorable to us.
That might make a difference. I have to go back and look at the record. You might be right about that.
Can you point to where that is in reference to the...
Yes, I think. It might actually be in my brief.
I think it's in the brief. That's my recollection. But I think it's in the record as well.
I was going to say, I hope it's in the record, not just in his brief, or we've got a problem.
But I think the reference initial, the one I remember is in the brief, but I think it's both in the record. I have it down part of the record.
I was sure if it's in his brief, Mr. Jeffrey's part of the record.
I said, on brief, I said 14 to 15 and 26 to 28. I think it may be the one that's the 28 site might be where it's clarified. But I think he said he walked him about 50 to 100 feet to the police car. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm not putting my hands on it immediately, but I do have a site. It's to 14 to 15 or 26 to 28. If it's...
You're talking about where he indicates that the officer...
Here, it's on 26.
...articulated on page 28. Is that what you're
talking about? I'm actually looking at page 26, line 17. Yeah. Give me long enough and I can find it. I walked into my police vehicle, and I then went to do a pat-down on his person. How far was it to your police vehicle? 50 feet, 50 to 100 feet. So I think red and the light most favorable to us, there is a break. And I don't recall, if you want me to look for this, if there's something that appears to conflict with that, I'll be happy to point it out to the court. But I don't think that there is anything that conflicts with that in terms of an earlier pat-down. I think that's what we have. And I...
Well, let me follow up on that then. Would the Commonwealth's position then be that if a police officer, there's nothing in the record about this, my own experience in such things is that usually police departments have policies about when you put people in a police car, what you do to make sure you don't, you know, wind up with contraband in your police car or an officer being attacked by somebody. And I suspect, you know, although the record is silent on it, that there may be a policy, for all I know, in this department that you at least pat people down before you stick them in a police car. I'm not sure how that squares with Terry, but to the extent that it might be relevant, it probably should be part of the record, I would suspect.
As far as the policy?
Yeah. I mean, it might be, as you point out, the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness, and it seems to me if that's, you know, reasonable to do because it's part of the departmental policy, that would go a long way towards supporting your argument, but again, as I say, the record is kind of silent about that.
I'm going to follow up on the policy issue. Policy in and of itself, you wouldn't argue, gets you to a reason for pat-down, would you?
No, because we could articulate a policy. To use another analogy, that if you're in this neighborhood, you pat down everybody you come in contact with, and we know that's not the law. But I mean, not to make light of it, but you're absolutely right.
You really don't
right.
like that opinion I wrote, did you?
No, apparently not.
Well, I think it is helpful to the extent that we don't have the officer doing that here. And I think that certainly was, if I reread that case, and it seems to me that certainly was a big part of your analysis in the case, and I don't mean to suggest that it was the only part.
I just liked your view, Chase, Mr. Jeffrey.
But this court said in Moore that you can do that type of search or type of pat down.
Is it more slightly factually distinguishable in the sense that there were multiple people and one single officer?
There are some facts that are different because you do have the multiple players, and it's very.
Didn't the court say essentially that was a unique situation essentially?
I don't know if the court went as far as to say that it's unique. There was policy testimony in that case. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was dispositive. And I think Judge Humphreys, if I'm remembering the analysis right, it was somewhat divorced from Terry.
Right.
That this is a safety issue, and it gives you objective justification. So I wouldn't go as far as to say that you need the policy testimony. You had it in Moore, and you had the court distinguish one where it said, look, that was just gratuitous. Go sit in my cruiser. And if you read the case, you'll see what I'm talking about. I don't want to stand up here and read it to you unless you want me to.
No, I've read it.
But yeah. the court very much distinguishes you can't do it gratuitously, and then you get the pat down as a justification.
Here, it always gets back to the totality of the circumstances.
Right.
Is it reasonable under the totality of the circumstances? If you got three people, one of them is clearly armed, that probably is going to give you a reason to pat down the other two, even though there's no overt, you know, suggestion that they are armed, but given the circumstances, a court arguably would find that to be a reasonable approach.
Here, I see my time's up.
You can answer the question. To the extent that was a question, you can try to respond to it.
And here the reasonable justification would be the show up, and that wasn't present in Moore. It wasn't present in the case that Moore distinguished, and I think that's the issue here, that it was reasonable to do it. I talked about waiver on brief. I'll rely on that unless the court wants to hear from me on it.
Thank you, Mr. Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Mr. Mazzio.
I would argue that it takes quite a bit of stretching to try to get to the point where the facts in this case do provide the Commonwealth the cover for the ruling that the court made in this particular case. I want to take issue first and foremost with the court's question to the Commonwealth about probable cause for arrest. I would disagree with the court's brief recitation and then the Commonwealth's brief general summary of the facts here. The description is in the record that's given to this officer that he's aware of when he has this encounter is that there was a white male with facial hair carrying a shopping bag of some kind. There is no clothing description that the officer can remember.
Well, was there also part of that he was also running in a particular direction as well? And the officer then saw someone later running in that direction?
Yes, but as a first point, the information he has about a potential description of the individual from the actual loss prevention officer is the white male with the facial hair and the bag. He's then given the information over the radio that there is some sort of pursuit of a person who's running. I don't believe the record supports that they identify in any positive way that that's the individual that that they're looking for, that they have any additional information there to suggest that this person is the individual. I think it is also relevant that we're talking about a best-case scenario for the Commonwealth from the record 30 minutes after this person might have been at the potential location where the larceny occurred, and at least, again, best-case scenario for the Commonwealth, at least 500 feet away where there is some type of a U-Haul establishment where there are potentially other people and other things going on, and then there is some type of a fence, and then there is the bowling alley where this eventually, the encounter eventually goes. So there are multiple businesses, and we don't know what else in between where this Walmart would have been, and then the 500 feet apart where the individual is then stopped. It does turn out to be a white male. There is no bag when he stops him, and there is no facial hair. I think he describes him as being unshaven or scruffy or something along those lines, but specifically when asked did the individual have facial hair, the officer says no. So I would argue, putting aside for a second the very brief detention that a court might determine the officer could have made to determine if this individual was the person involved with the shoplifting, I don't think there's anything to go beyond that, and I would think at that point, once the description was not even met, absent any questioning or any additional factors, it would not even permit the officer to hold the individual at that point any further, let alone support probable cause for arrest. I don't think there are any factors in this case that would suggest that there was probable cause that was even possibly could have been found by this particular officer. I would also argue that the only two factors the Commonwealth can point to for armed and dangerous in the totality of the circumstances is that the individual was running, and again, if we want to view this in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, I suppose hiding in the bushes, but I think the record specifically says that he jumped back into the bushes upon encountering the officer. I think it's just as equally likely to conclude that there was some form of surprise or shock that this officer was there, and the fact that it was 2:00 in the morning. There are no other factors in this case that I have seen anyone suggest or point to that support that a further pat down. I don't think that there's probable cause for an arrest. I don't think that there's anything to suggest that this individual was armed and dangerous. And I don't think that there's probable cause for any further search of the individual going forward. I disagree that the situation necessitated the officer placing him in the back of the vehicle. I think if there was evidence on the record to support that that was necessary, where the officer gave an explanation as to why that was the most reasonable or necessary choice under the circumstances, that the court could find from a policy perspective, perhaps, that maybe there was a reason for the pat-down at that point if he's going in the back of the car. I don't concede that, but I also would suggest none of those factors are here. All we know is that he decided he was going to take him to a different location. And under the facts of what we currently know and what other alternatives may have been available, I don't believe that that would be reasonable. I know the Commonwealth didn't address it today, and the court didn't have any questions about it. I did want to ensure before I finish my time that the court did not have any questions about the Commonwealth's allegation that these arguments were waived by the filing of the initial motion in this case by trial counsel. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. We will come down and recounsel, and the court will be adjourned until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.